Today we're going to talk about the topic of self-control. And I have titled this lesson, The Freedom of Self-Control. And I want to make a case that self-control, as the way the Bible describes it for us, is really the only way to truly be free. And I'm going to make that case to you in just a few minutes. But self-control is not really something that the world tends to value very highly. And the reason why is because it's a concept that many would push back on because they view it as limiting or, you know, puritanical or stuffy or something like that. Prudish might be a way that people might think about this word. But it's a concept that's critical to being a Christian. It's listed as sort of the final description of the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5. After he lists all of those things that the fruit of the Spirit is, self-control comes at the end of that list. But the reason why the world pushes back on it, I think, is because there's this cultural narrative that many people have bought into, that if you really want to be free, if you really want to live your best life, then you don't need to let anybody tell you what to do. And even more importantly, you don't need to let anybody tell you what not to do. And so the idea that we would make decisions based on what some expectation is of us would seem like it's sort of threatens our freedom on the surface. You do you and you be true to yourself is sort of the idea. I want you to consider this proverb. Proverbs 25 and verse 28 says, "A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls." I really like that idea. The idea is that if we don't have self-control, if there's nothing that guides our actions or our lives, then we leave ourselves vulnerable. Let me give you an example of that. If you always do whatever you want to do, is that really freedom? Or is it slavery? You know, if you just always follow whatever your impulse is, you know, this looks good, this looks like it might feel good, this looks like it might be fun, this looks like something I want to do, then really you're not free, you're just a slave to whatever your desires are, aren't you? And desires change. You might want one thing today and a different thing tomorrow. And so you're really just a slave to whatever your impulses are, if that's the way you live. In fact, when you really think about it, that doesn't really make you that much different than the animals, does it? If you just sort of do whatever feels right or looks good in the moment. Well, think about another thing. Then what if you let your desires be filtered by what society tells you is acceptable? Is that what freedom is? Well, let me give you an example of that. I want you to imagine with me that there is a man that has two desires in his heart, okay? One desire is that he wants to murder his enemies and burn their houses down. Okay. The other desire is for homosexual relationships. He's got both desires in his heart. Now imagine that that man lives in a 9th century Viking village. The idea of burning your enemies' houses down would be something virtuous in that society. That would be encouraged, but he would probably suppress his desire for homosexual relationships. But now imagine that that same guy doesn't live in a 9th century Viking village, but imagine that he lives in a 21st century American city. It's probably the exact opposite, isn't it? It would be frowned upon to murder your enemies and burn their houses down, but he would feel more at liberty to pursue homosexual relationships. And see, when you think about an example like that, what it illustrates for us is that if we let society or let culture determine what's acceptable, that's not actually freedom either. We're just a slave to whatever society and culture tells us is acceptable or unacceptable. And that's the meaning of this proverb, is that a lack of self-control leaves us vulnerable. If we don't control ourselves, then something or someone else will control us. And the fact is, we are letting something control our behavior, no matter who we are, no matter what kind of beliefs we subscribe to. It might be our desires, it might be our culture, it might be whatever we think is practical for us. But nobody just lives without self-control. And so it seems then that the question is not, should I have self-control? But how should I control myself? What should be what dictates how I live and what I do. And so what we're going to discuss today is, in the freedom of self-control, how to understand it, how to develop it, and where it comes from. So let's start with how to understand it. The word self-control in the New Testament comes from this Greek word, which is pronounced something like ingrataia, but the idea is it's from two different words, in, which means in the sphere of, and kratos, which means dominion or mastery. And so properly, when you put those together, it's self-control. It's dominion within. Synonyms for this word would be self-mastery or self-restraint or even continence, the ability to control yourself, have dominion. Look over in Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, we see an example with Cain and Abel. And I want you to see this idea of dominion that's presented here for us in this temptation. Genesis 4 and verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. I like the way the New American Standard also translates that verse. It says, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. When you get right down to it, isn't that what the problem is with every sin that we deal with? The problem is this is mankind's struggle. The heart of every sin is that temptation appeals to a part of me that I know that I should subdue, I know that I should master. I have this division within myself where I want to do this thing, but I also find myself wanting to do this thing, and something that Paul says in Romans 7 seems appropriate. He says, I don't do the thing that I do, and I do the thing that I don't. And we end up doing the thing that we know that we shouldn't have done. But God says, you must master it. You must rule over it. Now, one thing that I want to observe right away from this story is that when God says that we need to do it, it means that it's possible. If you've ever really struggled with self-control, then that's important for you to hear, because sometimes it feels like it's not possible. Sometimes you feel like you are stuck in such a way that you just, no matter what you try, you can't break free. But if God gives us the responsibility, he always gives us the ability. And if God says you must rule over it, that means that it's possible for us to have self-control. Look over in the book of Titus. I want you to see how Paul wrote to Titus about self-control. This actually comes up a lot in this book. Titus chapter 1 in verse 7. For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. So, for somebody to serve as an overseer or an elder, self-control is something that they have to have. In chapter 2 and in verse 2, he says, older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Then he talks about the young women in verse 4. So train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled. And then down in verse 6, he says, likewise urge the younger men to be self-controlled. You notice that nobody's really left out of this. Everybody is expected to have self-control, whether you're an old man or an old woman or a young man or a young woman. But how is it that Paul wanted Titus to make sure that these people grew in self-control? Well, if you look down in chapter 2 and verse 11, he says, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works. What I want you to see here is that as Paul describes how God expects all of these different groups of people to have self-control, ultimately what he gets to is where this self-control comes from. And this is sort of our first hint at how to develop it and where it comes from, is that it's a part of the fruit that comes by the training of grace. You see that? In verse 11, he talks about how the grace of God has appeared, and in verse 12, that grace is training us. The grace of God is not something that just saves us in the sense that we're saved and that's it, but the grace of God continues to have an impact on us. It continues to change us and train us. Something about Jesus, his life, his example, his sacrifice, it motivates us and it teaches us according to this text. Now, also look at verse 12, and that tells us the things that are opposed to self-control. In verse 12, it's training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions. And by contrast, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives. And so if God's grace is having the impact on me that it should have, if I can identify ungodliness in my life, if I can identify worldly passions in my life, then God's grace is going to help me to put those things away, to break free of that, to leave that behind, and instead to live in a way that's self-controlled and godly. That's what Paul is telling us. Now, another thing that I want you to see in this text is that there is a past and a present and a future component of how this works. In verse 11, that is referring to the past, what has happened, the grace of God has appeared. Verse 13 refers to the future. We are waiting for our blessed hope. We're waiting for Christ to come back and to enjoy heaven eternally. But then verse 12 is the present. So what happens between the past and the future is self-control in the present. Self-control is what I practice in the present based on what God has done in the past and what he will do in the future. Now, I don't claim to be very wise. I don't know if I'm old enough to be wise yet, so take it for what it's worth. But in my limited experience, one thing that I have noticed about what's wise is that what is wise is almost always the decision that takes into account the greater perspective. If we look too much at the present, if we look too much just at this moment, what seems good right now, what I want right now, that's when we make very unwise choices. But when we focus on the entirety of it, when we see the past and when we see the future, that's when we can make the wisest decisions, and that's when self-discipline happens. Often, that means delayed gratification, doesn't it? Is that if I factor in what the whole picture is with the past and the future, then I might make a decision right now that's not so fun. It's not as enjoyable because I know that in the big picture, that's going to be what is the best decision to make. Look over in the book of 2 Peter. Peter really argues the same way about how we ought to have self-control. 2 Peter chapter 3 in verse 10. He says, "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief." That's in the future. "And the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness?" You see, those are the same kinds of things that Titus told us are the things characteristic of self-control. And Peter is arguing the same way, is that based on the future, based on the fact that there is going to be judgment against sin, then the rational response is to live in self-control in the present. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 7 makes a very similar point. We talked about that in our 1 Peter series in the afternoons. Remember, Peter says, the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be self-controlled, is what he says there. Look over in Acts chapter 24, though. I really like the way that Paul reasons with Felix here in Acts 24. Acts 24 and verse 24. After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you." Just stop there. You know, isn't it interesting that when Paul has this really wonderful experience to stand before somebody like Felix and to talk to him about faith in Jesus, that Paul's three-point sermon could be summarized in that way, that it's about righteousness, self-control, and the coming judgment. I would have loved to have heard what Paul had to say to Felix, because Felix is shaken up by it. You know, at the end of it, I don't know exactly what Paul said, but Felix is alarmed, and he just sort of says, "Paul, just go away. Like, I don't really want to talk about this stuff." But notice that when Paul preaches about faith in Jesus to Felix, it is centered on self-control, but it's about the past and the present and the future. You know, you might think about Paul talking about what Jesus has done in the past to achieve righteousness for us, and the coming judgment in the future, but what that means is that in the present, self-control is the rational way to live. And he makes that case to Felix. That self-discipline is reasonable when we're able to consider more than the present moment. I think that for a moment, Felix saw how important this was. He saw the greater perspective, and he realized the conclusion was unavoidable, that if he did not get control of himself now, that what that boiled down to is that Satan would have control of him for eternity. And that's a really uncomfortable thought, and that's not something that we want to think about, and so sometimes we make the same decision as Felix. We say, you know, maybe there are things in my life that I need to control, and maybe there are things that I need to change, but all of this is just really uncomfortable. I don't like to think about it. Just go away for the present. And we put it off. And I hope that we don't make the same mistake that Felix made here. And so now that we understand a little bit about how self-control is discussed, let's talk about how to develop it. How do we actually develop this quality in ourselves? If you go over to 2 Peter chapter 1, I want to show you where self-control comes up in this list. Peter talks about different virtues that we ought to have if we're following Jesus. And in 2 Peter 1 in verse 3, it says, "His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control." Okay, stop there. Now, listen, I know that in verse 8, he's going to say that if these qualities are yours and are increasing, they keep you from being ineffective or unfruitful. So, in one sense, these qualities are a total package deal. You can't really have one of these without the others. It's sort of like the Beatitudes or like the fruit of the Spirit. To have one is to have them all. To lack one is to lack them all. That's true. But in another sense, Peter does talk about these qualities as being sort of additive, doesn't he? You know, he says that you start with faith in verse 5, but then we add to our faith or supplement our faith with virtue. Now, that seems very logical to me. Faith would be this idea that you believe God and that you trust God. That's where virtues have to start. If you're going to grow in godliness, then you have to believe in God and you have to trust God. But if you believe God and if you trust God, then add to your faith virtue. That would be the idea of moral excellence. The idea of having a soft heart, of being receptive to what God has to say. So we believe him and we trust him, and then we have virtue, and then we add to our virtue knowledge in verse 5. That would be sort of like widening our perspective like we talked about. Knowledge of what God has done in the past and knowledge of what God will do in the future. And at that point, if we have faith and virtue and knowledge, self-control is what is produced. You see, I think this gives us some idea of a roadmap to developing this quality. Contrast that process with verse 9. In verse 9, he says, whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins. You know, that really makes the same point that we made earlier, doesn't it? Is that if we focus too much just on what's right in front of us, we're not going to have self-control. And I don't think the idea is that, like, you wake up one morning and it just slips your mind, like, oh man, totally forgot Jesus died for me, you know? But the idea is that you live your life in such a way that you're not thinking about that. You live your life in such a way that you're just thinking about what I want right now and what seems good right now and what other people expect of me right now. And he says, if you live that way, you're nearsighted. If you're nearsighted, you won't have self-control. So it's the same point that he makes there in verse 9 that we've talked about already. But the text makes another important observation for us. In verse 5, he says, for this very reason, make every effort. We talked about this a little bit last week in 1 Peter. But you know, if I'm being honest with myself, a lot of times my problems with self-control have been because of this. Because I wasn't doing that. I mean, maybe I made some efforts, right? I mean, it's not that I didn't try at all, but did I make every effort? Did I really give it all that I could give it? We talked about last week that it's easy for us to convince ourselves sometimes that we're struggling with sin. We use that phrase, I'm struggling with this thing. Are you struggling? Or are you just letting it have its way with you? You see, for us to have self-control, there is a component where we have to fight. You know, in 1 Peter chapter 5, we talked about that our adversary is the devil and we have to resist him. We have to actually try hard. And sometimes that's going to be uncomfortable. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I like the way that Paul talks about this here. He uses some analogies that relate to athletics. In verse 24, do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Now, here his basic point is that athletes work very hard to achieve what? I mean, to ride on a parade with a big ring on their hand, right? To hold up a trophy. In Paul's day, to put on a perishable wreath, you know, like a grass kind of crown, laurels. And the point is if people work so hard for these things that are ultimately worthless, how much harder should we be fighting for what's at stake? You know, it's not about some kind of sports event. It's not about some kind of Super Bowl or championship. What's at stake is our eternal souls. And so if athletes discipline their bodies, and if athletes dedicate so much to being able to strive after things that are relatively unimportant, what does that say about the kind of dedication that we ought to have? I don't know if you've ever had an experience in sports where, you know, something just kind of like a switch gets flipped in your mind. I'm very competitive. Several weeks ago, Nancy McGuire got out the ping pong table at her house, and the beast inside of me sort of came alive a little bit. Sorry, David. But you know, we had a good ping pong match, and I don't like losing. I just really don't. And it doesn't mean that I'm good. I mean, I'm not. I'm not good at ping pong. I just don't like losing. But you know, I grew up playing baseball. And, you know, there's this part of me that when there's a competition, when there is an opponent, that there's like a switch inside of me that gets flipped. You know, it's like something comes alive where I just feel like, I'm not going to lose. I don't care how hard it is. I don't care what it takes. I don't care how much it hurts. I'm just not going to get beat by this, you know. Maybe you can relate. Now, notice, though, that when Paul talks about who his opponent is in this context, who is it that Paul is fighting against? Or who is it that Paul is disciplining? In verse 27, he says, I discipline my body and keep it under control. The word for that is from a Greek word that literally means to strike under the eye. To give someone a black eye is the idea. So when you look at this word, what is Paul saying? Paul is saying, in a sense, that he is fighting himself, that the opponent is him. He's saying, I am going to war against me. The only other place in the New Testament where this word is used is in Luke chapter 18 and verse 5. It's the parable of the persistent widow. And in that verse, Jesus mentions that the ruler says, because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. I really like that. You know, what Paul is saying is, in a sense, is that I have to beat myself down to have self-control. I have to discipline myself. I need to look myself in the eye and say, you will not win this. You might want one thing, but I am going to win. I am going to have control. There's a competitive kind of aspect to this. There's a famous comic strip in 1971 from a comic strip called Pogo. Famous line, though, we have met the enemy, and he is us. I think that's what Paul is recognizing here, is that if he is going to have self-control, that he has to have mastery over himself. And sometimes that's a violent struggle. Sometimes that's very difficult. And so where does that come from? I want to be clear that for us to have self-control in our lives, we have to bring the fight. I mean, we have to want it. We have to be willing to do what's hard sometimes, to do what's right. But the only problem with all of that is that if we're not careful, we might forget where the true strength comes from. And we need to remember that too. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, Paul says, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. When Paul talks about himself in Colossians chapter 1, he says, for this I toil, struggling with all his energy that he powerfully works within me. You see, the thing about all of this is that I have failed enough in my life to know that I can't trust myself. Like, I've just proven that. Any time that I've tried to do things by my own strength or to have self-control by my own power, I've disappointed myself and I've failed. But I've succeeded enough to know that I can trust the Lord. I'm not strong because of my own strength, because my own strength is not strong enough, but his is. And the reason why we can know that Jesus is actually the one who can give us the strength to have self-control in our lives, that Jesus is the one who can help us to live these self-controlled lives, is because Jesus has proven his ability by his own example. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, Jesus is the only one of whom it can be said, he has been in every respect tempted as we are, yet without sin. 1 Peter 2 and verse 22 says that he committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. And when you think about that, at first we might think, well, then that means Jesus wasn't really tempted as much as we are. No. That means that he was tempted more than we are. Satan gave him the full force of temptation to try to knock him over, and he couldn't do it. And the amazing thing about what that means for us as Christians is that we can do all things through him who strengthens us. Isn't that what Paul said in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13? We can't trust ourselves, we can't trust our own strength, but we can trust the strength that Jesus gives us. And Jesus is the one who's proven that he has perfect self-control. Look over in Romans chapter 8. I think Romans 8 really gives us some specific direction on this. As we struggle with our temptations and the flesh and trying to walk by the Spirit, he says in verse 13, "For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the spirits of God, by the Spirit of God, are sons of God." Now, notice that he doesn't say, by the flesh, put to death the deeds of the body, but he says, by the Spirit, put to death the deeds of the body. Well, how do we do that? We'll go back up to verse 9. In verse 9, "You, however, are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if, in fact, the Spirit of God dwells in you. Anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. But if Christ is in you, although the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is life because of righteousness." When I put all that together, what that tells me is that if I want to have self-control, if I want to practice righteousness and repent of sin, if I want to become like Christ, then Christ has to be in me. That's the only way. That's the only way I can have the strength to do that. That he must become the all-consuming passion in my life. To relate it back to what we talked about in 2 Peter 1, I think that's the kind of faith that virtue and knowledge and self-control can be added to. And so, ultimately, I think that we should be encouraged. If you feel like self-control is unattainable, if you feel like you are discouraged by your ability to control yourself, then the hope for us is that self-control is not ultimately just control of ourselves, but it's the resolved decision to relinquish control and confidently commit that control to Jesus. Self-control is not control of yourself alone, but committing that control to the Lord. And really, that is at the core of discipleship. Whenever Jesus talked about what it meant to follow him, he would say things like this. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 23, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." What Jesus is telling us is that we will finally find life when we stop trying to let our master be us and start letting our master be him. And so the invitation to have self-control is the invitation to trust Jesus. Do you trust him? Do you trust him more than you trust yourself? Do you trust him more than you trust your impulses? Do you trust him more than you trust your society or your culture? Do you trust him more than what seems practical to you in this moment? And when you do, you'll follow him and you'll obey him. And when you follow and obey Jesus, he will lead you to the true freedom of self-control. You will begin to want to do what you ought to do. And that's where true freedom is. I hope that's encouraging. I hope that we see how important self-control is for us and how following Jesus offers us self-control like nothing else can. And if there's somebody here that needs to develop a relationship with Jesus or to come into a relationship with Jesus, then if you are baptized into Christ, then Christ can be in you today. That's the invitation of the gospel. If you believe that Jesus is the Son of God and you're willing to follow him, you can respond to it. If you need to make your life right with God in some way, if there's some sin you want to repent of, if there's something you want to share with the group here so that we can pray with you and help you, that's what we're all here for. And so if you need to make your life right with God and we can help you in any way, please come to the front and let us know how while we stand and sing.